Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC FM and AM and WNYC.org. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Well, you may not have paid much attention to Tuesday's primaries around the country. Not everyone was on the edge of their seat, for example, to see who will be running for Iowa's 3rd congressional district in November. But at least one of the results may have implications for important reforms right now in Washington. Senator Blanche Lincoln won the Arkansas Democratic primary by a very slim margin, and her victory is bringing special attention to one piece of financial reform she's been fighting for in Washington. Heidi Moore, contributor to Slate's Big Money, joins us to talk about this particular proposal and the Finance Reform Conference Committee, which kicks off today. Heidi, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here. Thank you.
All right. First, tell us about the derivatives bill that Senator Lincoln has been pushing for. Break it down for all of us who aren't Wall Street banking experts, will you?
Sure. Well, even the experts find this a little bit confusing. Basically, what Senator Lincoln is proposing is that banks would spin off their derivatives and swaps businesses. So those are two Wall Street jargon terms that are basically names for types of transactions where you can take a part of a security and hedge against it. So, for instance, if you see interest rates going up in another country, you can create a security to protect yourself against that. If you see commodity prices going up, and those are called derivatives and swaps. So Senator Lincoln believes that these create more risk, and they do to a certain extent, and she doesn't want banks to own part of them. But unfortunately, the opposition to derivatives and swaps also creates its own complications, which is that banks can spin off those businesses, but if they fall into trouble anyway, it's likely that the banks will still bail them out.
Well, she may be well-meaning with the legislation, derivatives and swaps, huh? I mean, could the reform, even if it goes through, really influence the banks and their risk-taking?
That's a good question. Probably not too much, because they can still own parts of these businesses. They can own up to 20%. And what we've seen also in the history of Wall Street is that when one way to making money is blocked, they'll find another way. So derivatives and swaps are not the only ways in which banks take risk. For instance, they take risk whenever they lend to companies. They take risk whenever they get involved in junk bonds, which are low-rated bonds. There are many ways for banks to take risk that have nothing to do with derivatives and swaps. So while this is kind of a hot-button issue and it looks very sympathetic because nobody likes these complicated securities, it may not actually work towards the goal of getting banks to act responsibly with the money we entrust them with.
Mm-hmm. We being the consumers. What about consumers? I mean, what could it mean in practical terms for consumers?
Well, a number of things. I mean, the derivatives bill is actually way at the top of the financial system. But if it does work to help banks take less risk, then presumably banks will be able to be free to lend to consumers, to make more home loans to people who meet requirements, and to make more bank loans and so on. So the idea is, if banks don't tie up their money in these kind of fancy derivatives, they can use it to help drive the economy at the lower levels, and we would all want that. So that would be one potential impact. Another impact of the bill, not the derivatives amendment, but the overall financial reform bill, is more documentation for mortgage loans. So the House and the Senate bills both would require people to provide proof of income to get loans. And another thing that would affect consumers is the creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, mm-hmm. which, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just acknowledging that. I think that's one thing that even we non-experts have heard about, this Consumer Protection Agency in this area.
Yes, exactly. And it actually should probably be getting even more coverage. It's a bit revolutionary. If you can believe it, in all of the history of American regulation of finance, we have not had a single agency to regulate retail consumers and their interests. So, for instance, those home loans and those car loans and those bank loans that we talked about, there was nobody really regulating those. And as we saw, that created a lot of trouble in how those were allocated and how people applied for them and how they were approved. So both the Senate and the House want to create a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. They go about it in slightly different ways. The House wants a standalone CFPA to police lending, and there's no process to veto what that agency does. The Senate wants to create it within the Federal Reserve, and so federal regulators could override what states are doing on a case-by-case basis.
And which of those two do you think is most likely to become reality, the standalone or within the Federal Reserve?
Well, right now, the word on the street is probably that the Federal Reserve has enough power to be able to absorb this CFPA. Ben Bernanke is a very strong political negotiator, and he can probably get the CFPA within the Federal Reserve, which would make the Federal Reserve probably the most powerful financial institution in the United States to an even greater degree to which it is now, because it would oversee everything from the small banks to the big banks to, you know, what happens with consumers, and it has a $2.3 trillion balance sheet. So then the question that we have to ask is, if the Fed does all of that, who's watching the Fed?
Yeah, which, of course, anticipated one of my next questions. But first, back to the larger derivatives bill. There is some opposition, Wall Street lobbyists and some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, and some administration officials opposing the bill. What's the argument against it?
Well, the argument against it is that it's not really necessary and that it wouldn't accomplish the goal of reducing risk, because, as we said, there are other ways for banks to take risk, and even if they do spin off those businesses, they still might be exposed to their losses because they would own part of them. So the opposition says this isn't really necessary, and this is a big profit center for banks, and there are reasons that you need these things. For instance, if, you know, McDonald's wants to protect itself against a rise in corn prices, it would have to do that through a derivatives or a swaps desk. Or if an American company does business in Britain and wants to protect itself against currency fluctuations in, you know, sterling or in the euro, they would need derivatives and swaps to do that. And it's just much easier for banks to do that all in one place rather than to contract it out through a series of complicated transactions to a subsidiary. So that's mostly the opposition, but the lobbyists are now facing a real uphill battle because all of this, the negotiation, is going to be televised. So this isn't happening in back rooms anymore, which obviously gives the advantage to the more populist elements.
Blanche Lincoln's an interesting character. You know, a year or so ago, no one had ever heard of her, unless you were from Arkansas or you were a political junkie. And now after healthcare, she's become somewhat of a celebrity nationwide. What can you tell us about her in this context? Why is she such an advocate for this proposal? And if she hadn't won this primary, would this part of financial reform have died?
It probably would not have died, but it would have been far more difficult to go through, just because she's the author of it and she's the main proponent. And the Senate, of course, is still... it still works on people. So if you have the main advocate lose a primary, then, you know, that person's drive to get something passed would be lost. But there are other people behind it, and so it probably wouldn't have died, but it may have been weakened, and the chances against it might have been greater. For Blanche Lincoln herself, you know, she is an interesting character, and I think she has an interest in this, obviously, because of Arkansas and Arkansas's role in the economy. You know, Walmart is there. And it actually is a bigger financial player than you might think. And she sits on the community, she oversees commodities regulations. And so her interest in the derivatives bill would be through that, right? A lot of commodities have to do with derivatives, contracts, and things like that. So that's where her interest in that comes from. But more importantly, she's really kind of an object lesson in how a savvy politician can seize upon a populist moment to push through legislation in a way that is also successful to that person's career. And we've seen some situations where that same kind of arc, narrative arc, has been completely botched, like in the case of Chris Dodd from Connecticut, who, you know, was a huge supporter of the hedge fund community and unfortunately somehow ended up on all the wrong provisions in the financial reform bill and had a real uphill battle for getting this thing through.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about Chris Dodd in a moment, but first I want to ask you about some other proposed reforms that may have a big impact on us. Are there any other proposed reforms that we should be looking at in the coming days and weeks?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things that might be really interesting is what happens with banks and the kind of capital that they need to have. So the Senate is proposing that banks that have more than $250 billion in assets, the mega banks, would have to meet really strict capital standards, which would mean, again, less risk-taking, but would also mean that there might be less lending because banks would have to hoard more cash to support their riskier activities. So capital standards is one issue that people really should watch. And then they also are focusing on executive pay, and I think that would be interesting for a lot of shareholders who are worried that we have set up the wrong incentives for people who lead banks. And with financial services being 20% of the, you know, of our economy, essentially, of you know, the biggest companies in the S&P 500, that's important because we want to make sure that the people who control the money have the right incentives to treat it properly.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. We're talking financial reform with Heidi Moore. She's a contributor to Slate's Big Money. Isn't there some rather unusual meeting or committee thing happening today, Heidi?
Why, the very thing, yes.
That's your opening.
Exactly. At 2:15 p.m. today, and it will be live on C-SPAN, there will be the first meeting of the House and Senate factions who are going to negotiate their respective 1,500-page bills to create a final financial reform bill, which they hope to go through by July 4th. And now it's really interesting because this hasn't happened in 11 years. Everyone forgot how to do it, where you have a public hearing where both sides, the House and the Senate, will propose additions and amendments, talk about it among themselves, and then propose it to the other side. And so that could easily be a three-week process, but it's also a historically interesting process because we haven't seen it since 1999, which was the last time that the financial services industry was overhauled.
Hmm. And let's come back to Chris Dodd. And we were talking earlier about Senator Dodd and Representative Barney Frank, who say they want a final version of the regulatory bill headed to the president's desk by the 4th of July. How likely do you think that is? And what might be the holdup, if any?
Well, you'd find how interesting it is, how interestingly fast things work on Capitol Hill when people have self-interest at stake. And in this case, the self-interest is that a lot of House members and Senate members have elections in the fall, in November. And so they really need the summer to go out and campaign and win their constituencies, particularly in a volatile year like this, where we're not really sure what's happening with incumbents, where there might be dissatisfaction in some districts with the administration's policies or with, you know, Republicans' response to them. So campaigning is going to be a huge issue that will probably force lawmakers out of their own self-interest to quickly go through that negotiation process. So that does raise the chances that this will get wrapped up by July 4th.
In such a critical election year as well.
Exactly.
And I have to ask you, speaking of the election year, I know we're about out of time, but I have to talk with you about the role of money in our election politics, especially given the Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman campaigns. Two very wealthy women of corporate backgrounds. These women in California won Republican nominations, Meg Whitman for governor, Carly Fiorina for a Senate seat. Whitman, of course, the former chief executive for eBay, Fiorina of Hewlett-Packard, former CEO. And both of these women spent millions of dollars on their primary races. And it's very interesting to me, Heidi, given the skepticism about corporate America on the part of the public and corporate ethics and Everything that we've seen go on Wall Street, and thinking of Enron, and I wonder that the voter is not more skeptical about this way of going about running a campaign. I know it's a little off your beat, but I wonder if you have any reaction to it.
Yeah, I actually think that it's a very interesting moment, and particularly we've seen a lot of skepticism come up because of what happened with BP in the Gulf, right?
So yes.
Capitalism really does have a black eye right now, and we are questioning the premises of the free market. That's what this financial reform legislation is about, and also kind of a wider global movement. I think what really surprises people about what's happening in California is the sheer dollar amounts that are going into these races. $100 million to win a primary in a state that's on the verge of bankruptcy.
Yes.
It just strikes one as obscene. But historically, in a historical context, when you actually look at the way American politics have worked, it's always been this way. It's always been people who make their fortunes first and then go into public service later. Thomas Jefferson was that way. George Washington was that way. That is essentially the way that American democracy was formed, which is by an elite class of, rich landowners, essentially, who then, made their fortune and decided to use their access and their power and their education and their understanding to help form America's policy. So historically, it's not an anomaly.
Meg Whitman, by the way, Heidi, I just want to point out, spent almost $150,000 per vote. We should say we're talking about their, as you point out so rightly, personal wealth, not in terms of fundraising, although there was that as well. But please go on with your analysis.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, basically, it would actually be cheaper in many cases for these candidates to just take every voter and send them to a re-education camp, rather than just, buy votes through, or I don't want to say buy votes because that's wrong, but rather than to try to influence people through television marketing and so on, which is incredibly expensive, although it is a terrific boon to the newspaper industry and towards the broadcast industry. But yes, I mean, it's the numbers that are a little bit obscene, but it is their money. And if they want to win that badly, that actually might be good because they're not beholden to other interests if they're raising that money from their own coffers, essentially. And you saw an example of that with Mayor Bloomberg, right? And so Mayor Bloomberg, spent obscene amounts of his own money to run for office in New York and has really kind of struck what most people would see as an independent platform for what he wants to do. So, the flip side of using all of this, obscene, almost pornographic amounts of wealth to win office is that it might help reduce the influence of special interests. Now, in a state as huge as California and as complicated as California, that may end up being completely untrue. But that is, if you want to find a silver lining, that is one silver lining.
And, of course, they have to win the general elections.
Exactly.
So we'll see how much money they spend to do that.
Right, which is challenging. And it's also interesting, of course, that they are women,
yes.
This path of being able to, pay your way, into a race is now open to women is kind of interesting as well.
Well, thank you so much for your comments on that and on everything else related to financial reform. That's Heidi Moore, contributor to Slate's Big Money. Thank you so much for being with us, Heidi.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And we will leave it there. Up next on the Brian Lehrer Show, we're going to talk about raising kids with disabilities, differently abled children. Jennifer Silverman is co-editor of the book My Baby Rides the Short Bus, and Sharice Ingram is a mother and contributor to the book. Both women are here. Stay tuned.